today, the Aussie housing crisis out to 2030 and beyond. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analysis, one of the posts covering finance and property news. It's Friday and Tarek is with me for another chat. Hi Tarek, how are you going?
You're not too bad, mate. How are you?
Pretty good. There's a lot going on. And a lot of the interesting interactions I'm having with people at the moment is questioning data. Like, who can you believe?
Yeah, there's a lot of that going around. I mean, you know, we got the ABS unemployment data earlier this week, and it showed an absolute huge number of jobs created. You know, I think it was in the 99.5%, you know, 99.5% in terms of percentiles for the outcome. And it's just a February. It's nothing special. It's nothing, you know, like a big bounce after a recession or something like that, or after, you know, I mean, you see that in the data sometimes. You know, you see it after a natural disaster, for example, when there's like a widespread cyclone or something along those lines. But this is just, it was just, you know, Tuesday. But here we are. We've got this, you know, huge blowout numbers. And then, you know, you've got the mortgage arrears, which came out today from Fitch, and they say the current level of mortgage arrears is 1.2%. Now, how accurate is that? I'm not sure. I'd be interested to have, you know, a bit of a discussion with you as to what you think, what your data is saying about where arrears may be. Because I mean, I know you, as you've said in the past, there's issues with it being represented by the securitization system, and you know, there's issues as well with how arrears are measured today compared with how they may have been measured in the past.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the mortgage arrears first, because it's right at the end of the process. If you think of, you know, people getting into difficulties and, you know, their missed payments, and ultimately there's an interaction with the banks. So the banks have been very lenient at the moment and have frankly bent over backwards quite often to extend and pretend, to move on to interest only, to push the term of the loan out, or even give repayment holidays for a period of time. So that's tended to put a bit of a lid on what's going on. But the other part of the story is the banks have also been encouraging people to put their property on the market and release the equity to pay the bank back and you know, walk away. And so that some of the listings that we're seeing at the moment are directly connected to people under pressure. At the end of the process, you then have this missing payments equals delinquency, 90 days, et cetera, and that's how the official statistics are actually reporting delinquencies. And so it's right at the end of the process. And then, of course, the other factor there is that the data sets that all of the agencies are using are the mortgage-backed securities, which are hand-picked mortgages anyway to start with. So you can pretty much be sure that if the average delinquency is a 1 point something, then you're going to find that there are pockets there, maybe some of the non-banks, maybe some of the higher risk mortgages, which are much higher. But there's also a seasoning issue. It takes a long time for this to work through. So I would expect to see the numbers continue to actually deteriorate in the coming months. And part of this, of course, is because there were a lot of people holding out hope that rates will get cut very quickly. I can remember the end of last year, people saying, well, by March, you know, rates will be down. Don't panic. Don't worry. Now, of course, the latest RBA conversation was, well, we don't know, really. It could go up, could go down, could go sideways. We're not sure. We'll have to watch the data. And of course, Chair Powell in the US was pretty much on the same track, even if he was, I think, even more confused than normal, which you might touch on in a second. Just going back to the employment data, the really important thing about here is that even some of the trend series were actually retweaked, if you look at what they did this time compared with what they did last time. So, you know, you can't rely on the trend series. And then the diabolical swinging around over the last two or three months suggests that there's really great uncertainty in the data set that's actually there. And part of that sampling, part of it's perhaps the seasonality that they normally adjust to is different this time around. Maybe more people actually took time off, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't think we got a really good compass. I made a show yesterday suggesting that we need a much better compass to be able to measure the unemployment story, because it doesn't seem to chime with vacancies. It doesn't seem to chime with some of the other data in my surveys where people are actually struggling to get the hours that they want. And in fact, the availability of jobs does seem to be down. So, I mean, we're in a fog, really. And no wonder the RBA is saying, well, we're going to watch and wait and see what happens, because we don't know either.
No, indeed. Like, the change in the trend data was huge. Like, the adjustments were huge. And I think it's also just worth noting that the working age population was also revised up just slightly for the periods that were covered by the recent ABS data. So, because there was a few people saying, oh, no, you know, the ABS employment working age population data is overstating things. And it turns out it was actually slightly understating things, which is, well, that's something. But yeah, I think that there's, you know, some rather major issues there, because, you know, when I looked at the data just a few weeks ago, you know, it was very much ringing alarm bells. You know, you've seen unemployment rise from 3.4% to 4.1%. Hours worked were going down the toilet, you know, and I was just looking at things, you know, in generally in trend terms, not the seasonally adjusted numbers, which are up and down like a yo-yo. But even those, as you say, have been drastically revised. So there's a lot of questions there. And I think the thing is, how, like, as you say, how is the RBA meant to make decisions based on this when one month unemployment's 4.1% and the next month unemployment is 3.7%? Because Bullock has sort of drawn a line in the sand around 4.5% unemployment. That is her point, where if unemployment starts rising significantly above that, that's when you're going to start to see the RBA get real uncomfortable about the situation of the labor market. But if we have a situation where unemployment, say, rises to, say, 4.7%, and then all of a sudden the RBA's like, well, what are we going to do here? We really better do something. This is deteriorating rapidly. And then you have another seasonality issue or another issue with the data, and then all of a sudden it's only 4.2% again. It's just going to be an absolute mess. And really, I think there should be probably a greater emphasis on this, because it's not the first time that this seasonality issue has cropped up. The hope from across the board was that they'd addressed it, but they clearly haven't, and it's actually gotten significantly worse.
Well, I think you can extend that to other data sets too. I mean, if I think of the US, the inflation... Yeah, the inflation, the retail and employment data in the US is all over the place as well. You know, and interesting, Powell said, well, yeah, you know, the data was a little bit good over the last few months, and it's gone a little bit bad over the last few months. But, you know, we're just sort of watching and waiting. It's almost like nobody quite believes any of the information that they're actually getting to be able to actually try and make decisions on. Now, you know, this is serious, because, of course, central banks are actually saying we want to be data dependent, right? We want to make sure that we actually see the cues and the clues before we start doing stuff. But with so much stupidity and volatility in so many data sets, how can they possibly be sure that what they're seeing is what they're seeing? And when you get conflicting information, such as, you know, consumer confidence on one end of the spectrum, or the jobs numbers elsewhere, what do you do? And as you say, retail, well, what do you do with retail?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, the Aussie retail sales data, like, you just write off the whole quarter. You write it off, and you just go, okay, what's the difference between, say, like, September and February? And that's what you use. You just forget about all everything else in between, because trying to measure for the seasonality is just a nightmare. You know, like, trying to glean anything useful from it is very, very challenging, because as they try to adjust for that seasonality, if it was just the same methodology as always, you could have then at least just go, okay, this is sort of what's happening, and then just come to your own conclusions. But because they are actively trying to fix it, it's very difficult to try and make a determination in that regard. And with inflation, that complicates matters further. So yeah, it's really quite a mess in that regard. And I'm not really sure exactly how they're going to solve this issue, because if you look at some of the numbers in the US, for example, on the response rates by the Bureau of Labor Statistics surveys, by the JOLTS survey, which is job openings and quits, etc., the response rates have collapsed since the pandemic. So the question is have we sort of been somewhat, you know, flying with one hand on one eye, just, you know, wondering if we're going in the right direction. And in actual fact, perhaps things were significantly better, and now perhaps they're significantly worse.
Yes, and it comes back to this fundamental point. If, in fact, all the central banks are actually being ultra data dependent, right, which is basically looking in the rearview mirror and trying to steer a path forward, and if they are actually relying on data that's all over the place, then how can they possibly make sensible decisions? And which is maybe why perhaps we are getting such confused messages out of the central banks. I mean, Powell pretty much said, well, if I see the job story turn around, even if inflation is still a bit high, I might do something. It's like, well, hang on a moment. Do you have a coherent plan, or do you not have a coherent plan, or is it really that nobody in central bank land knows what on earth is going on? I actually made another show yesterday calling central bankers. They're actually in Wonderland. It's like anything could happen, really. Anything could happen.
Yeah, I don't. The thing is, I don't think there is a coherent plan because it's very, very difficult to come up with a plan. A when as we previously mentioned, you don't have a fantastic understanding of what's actually going on because your data isn't amazing. But then you look at, like, say for example, the UK inflation story, right? The narrative is, oh my, oh, it's coming down, everything's great, the Bank of England's going to cut rates as soon as May, and maybe they will. I don't know, but if you actually look at the partials of the data, it's almost all goods inflation with where prices are coming down, and with energy and with food, which is, some, don't get me wrong, very welcome, but services inflation is still 6%. So if for some reason, say, I don't know, oil terminals start getting hit in Russia, which
Oh,
they're
funny
already
that.
targeting refineries, well, or someone were to do something and impact the flow of trade through, I don't know, the Red Sea, perhaps, then you could see even goods, not so much goods inflation, but goods disinflation, as in falling goods inflation, come to an end. Even if it's at a relatively moderate level, even if goods inflation in the UK bottoms out at, say, 0.5%, that's still more than enough to make the Bank of England miserable. Yet the idea is that rate cuts ahead, everything's fine, everything's going to be dandy. And we have the same issue here in Australia, but admittedly to a lesser degree than in Britain.
Yeah, although it's interesting, of course, because there was a lot of headlines in Australia about the energy prices will come down, whoopee, whoopee. Hang on a moment. What about the fact that the reason energy prices are where they are is because of the huge government support that's been in place, which will be going to disappear? If you take that away, energy prices are going to go up.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, realistically, it's going to contribute up to about, let's call it about a sort of 8 to 11% the level of energy of electricity price inflation if there are no further subsidies. So, yeah, that's going to be quite challenging. I mean, that's potentially going to add up to, off the top of my head, almost 0.3% to the year-on-year CPI. Now, that's excluded from the ones obviously that includes energy, but it does add to the headline CPI. So, challenging times ahead in that particular regard.
Yeah, and don't mention the rents and the lack of housing, which takes us very nicely into the whole debate about housing and what's going on, right? Because as we'll see as we get into this, the truth is that there's no simple short-term fix at all on the horizon. In fact, everyone's talking about, well, we'll do some stuff, but it's not going to be particularly impactful in the short term, or probably even in the medium term, which means that the housing stupidity that's been going on will continue for a way, way long time. Which sort of takes us to the slides, doesn't it?
It does nicely. We should get into them. As usual, folks, the charts are available at avidcom.substack.com. Big thank you to everyone who has subscribed and who's made a contribution. That is very, very much appreciated. As I mentioned previously, if you would like to commission me to write an article or do an analysis, my email is in with the charts. So we'll get right into it because we've got a few charts to get through today. Now, this doesn't look like much. This is a chart from the AB based on the ABS data of the average household size since 2005. Now, as you can see there, for the first almost 7 years there really wasn't that much movement. sort of nothing really happened to any significant degree. Even if we go all the way out to late 2016, it still wasn't a huge movement. You're talking about, sort of 0.25 over that period. And except since 2017, we have seen the size of households continue to fall, which has added significantly to the number of homes that are required. Now, I'm just going to go to the next slide to provide this data in a bit of a different context. This is the number of additional homes that we need versus 2005 that we need as a result of falling household sizes. It's over 350,000. If we're purely in the last decade, because this data unfortunately only covers until mid-2023, we needed an extra almost an extra 320,000. So if you think about Albo's call to we're gonna build 1 million homes, and then factor in that of that million, over 150,000 are just going to be needed based on changing demographics, age, an aging population, etc. That's going to be very, very difficult to achieve. Now, when we put it into a context of the fact that we have a housing shortage, a housing deficit, it becomes even more difficult because it means that that's another 30,000 or ish homes that you need, additional homes that you need to build every single year just to get back to break even. And I did a very, very rough calculation based on changing household sizes and migration just a few hours ago, and I came to a figure that conservatively the housing deficit has risen from the 120,000 the RBA and NAB were talking about earlier last year to by the end of 2023 of about 170,000. So when you've got to build another 30,000 a year on top of what we're already building just to break even, it's a pretty tall ask.
Yeah, and just to set that in context, there was a report that came out quite recently that said the capacity to build is actually dropping quite considerably, you know. And I think they were suggesting in the next few years it was more like 80,000, 90,000 if you're really lucky. And they also made the point that there's actually a lot of partially constructed property which isn't complete, getting completed. So you've got this sort of backlog of approvals into half-finished properties. And the forward projections on what the capacity to build is way below what's required to meet the 1 point, whatever it is, 1.2 million or whatever it is that the government's targeting. And just to underscore again, the migration number was hot, really hot.
Yes. I mean, just solely based on the migration number for year on year for the third quarter of last year came in 30,000 higher than the previous figure. It came in at 548,000 for the trailing 12 months. So that's a lot of houses that, I mean, just based on some very, very basic calculations of, sort of no addendums whatsoever, that's already over 200,000 homes that we need just for the new arrivals. And there's also another factor that I think is underappreciated and something that is really going to somewhat rear its ugly head going forward, which is because housing prices are so high, because the cost of transacting is so high, with stamp duty, with I mean, a 2 or 3% agent's fee wasn't a huge big imposition when a house was worth $500,000. But when you're talking about selling a house that in some parts of Sydney, Melbourne, even affluent parts of the other capitals, that's $2 million, all of a sudden you're forking out something that could buy you quite a nice family car. So the problem is a lot of people are turning around and going, well, bugger it, I'm not going to move. If I'm going to have to pay X amount of stamp duty and Y for the agent, I can put that towards building myself a really nice house where I am right now. So the number of homes actually being added to overall dwelling stock has fallen. Back at the start of the ABS series for actual and quarterly estimated dwelling stock back in 2016, for each one home that was completed, it added about 0.91, 0.92 homes to overall dwelling stock. Today, it's in a downtrend. The downtrend hasn't stopped. And it's currently 0.85. I wouldn't be surprised if it falls to, 0.8 dead. So that would then mean that one in five homes being completed doesn't add to dwelling stock at all. It's just someone rebuilding, knocking down a home and rebuilding it. So I think that re is really going to pre present, along with the demographic issues I've mentioned and a few other things, is really going to prove to be quite challenging for the government to address because, well, there's only one lever that they can really pull to address this in the short term, and that is much, much, much lower migration to a degree of, I'd say, probably less than a quarter of what we have now to get this in any way solved in sort of 2 to 4 years.
Yeah, and there's been a bit of a chorus arising about questioning the migration story. Of course, some parties are pushing it quite strongly, others less so. And in fact, it's the Greens are still saying, "Oh, no, migration isn't the problem," which is interesting. I thought for the Greens they might be a little bit more concerned about the volume of people coming to the country, but don't seem to be. Although they are talking about housing and the housing crisis, but there isn't really a path forward, is there? And the other point of worth just dwelling on for a second is that the cost of construction of new dwellings is continuing to rise. So if you look at the cost of labour and the cost of materials, they're still going up, which means that if you do decide to knock down and rebuild, that's going to cost you more. Or indeed, if you start building new stuff, it's going to cost you more. And that's one of the reasons why I think that many developers are just sitting on the sidelines, sitting on the land they're holding, so basically banking it, right? Because they know in the future it's going to be worth even more, because at the moment it's uneconomic to build more. So as well as the raw law of numbers of supply and demand, you've also got the economics of how much it costs to actually build versus the income you can generate from it. So it's a real big mess, and I don't think that there's actually any path that any of the major parties are offering at the moment, which is a solution to the problem, as you say, other than turn the migration tap right down.
I think the part of the question is it just for the construction sector in isolation, in a vacuum, I'm not sure how we're going to solve this issue because it costs, as you say, it costs X amount to build a house. Developers are happy to sit on land. A lot of developers, at least, are happy to sit on land for years and years. I mean, Cameron Murray, who you've had on here a couple of times, talked about some people sitting on land for 30 or 40 years. Even after it was zoned, just because reasons, because the number go up. But the question for me is, are we going to kill the construction sector? Have are we are is rising costs just going to get to the point where building a new home without some form of government subsidy or some sort of other incentive, outside of some of the smaller capitals like Perth, where, building a new home can still be a relatively attractive prospect. But in places, like that account for the lion's share of construction work, residential construction work, I should say, Sydney and Melbourne, what is going to happen there when you get to the point where people can no longer afford to build new? Because the people generally building new out on these estates are not people who are, extremely highly affluent people, who earn, really, really huge money. They're sort of regular everyday Australians in a lot of cases. So my thought is, and this is something that I've discussed with developers myself, is have we basically got to the point where we have just killed a decent swath of the construction sector, and there's nothing that we can really do about that until either prices get even more stupid, which is admittedly challenging, or developers start to accept big haircuts on the cost of the land price component.
Well, there are two other levers. The first lever is that the government, state and federal, will be paying more money directly to developers, right, to give them effectively subsidies on what they're doing, and/or the governments will be handing out more money to prospective purchasers to allow them to purchase. So both of those are effectively, taxpayers' monies in some way going in through the back door or the side door to try and support the construction sector, without solving the problem, because all they're doing is actually just creating the problem on steroids, essentially. Because the more you put prices up, the more you enable developers to be supported. And I've heard quite a few developers crying and saying, we need support from government to be able to build. I mean, but those aren't solutions, are they? They're just sticking plasters on a gaping wound and not really solving the problem at all. In fact, creating probably more of a problem.
Well, that exactly, and I think that's really the potential long-term issue. It's like What if we get to the point where, whereby consistent government intervention, the refusal to allow housing cycles in the construction sector and in terms of housing prices to play out in an organic way, which keeps a lid on prices and keeps a lid on costs as well. By not allowing those cycles to play out, what if they've created a situation where they've created an existential threat to brought to great swaths of the construction sector, which directly or indirectly, according to some sources, employs something like almost 1 in 12 Australians. Well, 1 in 12 Australians who work, obviously. But it raises some pretty serious questions as to the long-term viability of the Australian construction sector. Because if rates, and part of the problem as well is this is also the RBA's fault, because they've created a situation where they crash-dived rates, the cost of housing went to the moon, the cost of building went to the moon, and now we've got a situation whereby the sort of mid-range scenarios for the cash rate are something starting with a 2. So, sort of like 2.5, 2.7, maybe at the low end of the 2s, but it's still nowhere near where they dropped it before. And if you start adding in the impact of the TFF, you get even further away. So we've developed this enormous gap between what is actually viable in terms of price and where prices are today.
And just to add the final perspective, if you look at it, the construction sector beyond residential construction, there's still a lot of government projects that are also being built. So effectively, the construction sector is also struggling to meet the demand from, big projects around the place, as well as the housing and construction sector. So again, what we're seeing is, little pieces of action around the edge, but actually negatively impacting the overall strategic sense. And the bottom line I have is that there's no joined up thinking at all around this. And as you say, you can sheet a lot of blame to the RBA, you can sheet a lot of blame to the federal government for some of their stupidity, as the state governments as well. There's a lot of different parties, and almost everybody's saying, it's not my problem, it's somebody else's problem.
Well, I think that's part of the federalized system here in Australia. The federal government pulls the lever for migration, and then they go, well, we don't have to build the houses. That's a state responsibility. And we have this endless circular debate of, well, that's housing is a supply issue. We apparently have the part of our brains missing where we consider the demand side of the issue, but then they just blame the states. And of course, the states can't build enough houses. They can't build enough infrastructure. It's not possible. I mean, okay, perhaps it is possible, but you would need like a sort of wartime economy, type thing with throwing huge and huge amounts of money around to get it done. And well, quite a different sort of approach, shall we say, to work than what we have today.
Yep, and then if you add in just over the other overlay, which is how much will banks lend? Because of course the other issue with the property sector is how big a mortgage can you get, and that of course has driven prices significantly higher too. So the whole credit story, and the fact that a lot of the initiatives over the last few years have increased the size of banks' balance sheets and their profitability because of the lending multiples, they've dialed that back a little bit now. But what it means is that people are actually having to reach for huge debts to try and get in to buy whatever property is there. And again, there are winners and losers. The winners, of course, are the banks. The losers are everyday Australians trying to pay the mortgage.
Yeah, I think that we've got this, sort of real circular sort of issue at this point where nothing is getting solved because we're not, because policymakers are not allowing normal cycles and normal economic scenarios to play out. If we were, for example, allowed to have falling housing prices, or we were allowed to have, because, part of the issue here in Australia is that we don't have normal market signals in our property market the same way that, say, America does in a lot of places. You say, for example, take Austin, which is in Texas. Now, Austin has been making a lot of headlines lately because its housing prices are crashing. But it's also making headlines because its rents are falling and falling significantly. Because what happened in Austin was developers looked at the situation, they saw the fact that rents were rising, and they saw the fact that property was still relatively affordable and land was affordable. So they turned around and they went, well, let's build a heap of apartments, heap of townhouses, heap of freestanding homes, and we'll take advantage of that. Because the market signal said to them, yields are high enough that you can do this. Now, that has then turned around and led to now falling prices because the market responded with supply and markets do what markets do. But it's still rents are still up significantly from where they were pre-COVID. Prices are still up significantly from where they were pre-COVID. So for the most part, developers are still doing just fine, but it just goes to show how a market works. Now, considering the enormous rental crisis we have here in Australia, the fact that we haven't have by some metrics a national rental vacancy rate of just 0.7%, which is by some metrics a record low, we should have builders coming out of the woodwork and developers coming out of the woodwork to build. But because prices are so high and disconnected from yields and normal cash flow driven property investing, it doesn't work like that anymore. And it hasn't worked like that for a long time. And that's part of the reason why, the incentive base is broken in Australian property.
Well, we don't have a free market. So, free market economics are not close to where we actually are. And there have been market manipulation from governments, I would say from big developers, and from the financial system as well. So essentially, everybody's sort of got their finger on the scales, as it were, which means that the market doesn't respond as you would expect it to respond. And what it means is that the victims, which are the homeless, or those trying to get into the property market, be they migrants or whether they're homegrown prospective purchasers, are being left out in the cold. And of course, the other factor is that you've got two-thirds of the population owning property, and the last thing they want to see is the value of their properties go down, and governments know that. So again, governments are very, very paranoid about making sure that property prices don't slide too much. Another finger on the scales there too. So no wonder the markets aren't working.
Just not to go, sort of too deep into it again, but I think part of the problem is that people need to realize that the property market being broken is a problem for everyone, not just for people who want to buy. If you take, say, for example, according to some surveys, the median age of a first home buyer in Australia is now as high as 37 years old at a national level. Some say lower, some say higher, but that is just one particular yardstick. Now, these people are spending the better part of a decade saving, scrimping, trying to get to scrape together every dollar they can because, this idea that you can just save 15% of your income and eventually you're gonna get 20% deposit for a house is nonsense. It's if you try on a median income to just do that and then buy a house in most of the capitals, the amount of time it's gonna take for you to save a deposit, with housing prices even rising at 5% annualized, is infinity years. So it's not viable. You've got to make sacrifices, significantly more sacrifices in general than a lot of other generations who went before when housing was cheaper and wages were growing faster. But the problem is that if you've got great swathes of the population under the age of, say, 37 or 40, who are paying all this money into their savings, just trying to scrimp and save to buy a home, that affects consumption. And you've seen that. You've seen the fact that real consumption for people in under the age of 35 has fallen since 2007, 2008. So in 16 years, that demographic has gone nowhere in terms of its consumption. Despite all the memes about avocados and iPhones and Bali and all the other bullshit, that they've gone nowhere. They're spending less now in real terms. They're buying less stuff than they were 16 years ago. And then the next stage of life comes. You buy a house, you take on this enormous mortgage, much, much larger relative to your income than all these other generations who've come before. And now, additionally, since 2022, there's interest rate risk as well. And all of a sudden, now your mortgage is sucking in all this money that you would have otherwise been spending in the economy. had it been more normal circumstances, you bought a property when you were 30 and you had good wages growth, so you had that ability to spend freely into the economy. Now, don't get me wrong, that exists in some quarters, but in general, it's the data, even from the RBA, shows that that is m a much, much less powerful force within the economy than it once was. And that now spending growth is overwhelmingly driven by boomers, which is not normal. So we've created this topsy-turvy economy that doesn't work for people, that ends up affecting everyone in everything from wages growth to social outcomes, because people having to live that sort of life in a lot of cases are not terribly happy people.
Absolutely. And just to sort of follow that logic, if you think about moving into retirement, a lot of people are now, because they bought later, are going to still have mortgages at the point of retirement, which means they're either going to continue to pay mortgage repayments when they're retired, or when they move to retirement, they pull some of the capital from their superannuation, the forced savings, to repay the mortgage. Which of course then potentially means they're going to be more in needing of government support rather than their own support. And if you're in the rental sector and you've paid rent through your whole life and you come into retirement, you have no choice but to continue to pay the rent into retirement and beyond. So everybody is being hit negatively by what is been playing out over the last 20 to 30 years. So you're right, it isn't just those who are trying to get onto the ladder at the bottom end, as it were. This spills over. It spills over nationally, and it spills over to pretty much all the demographics.
Yeah. And, it's also just that we have a system as well that that requires, in a lot of cases, a home to borrow to make a business, as opposed to just taking a risk on some young person with their crazy idea in their parents in their parents' garage. And that's part of why America is the vibrant, innovative place it is from a business perspective. And why Australia is focused on housing so heavily. And part of the issue as well is that if you're 37 years old and you finally built some, well, if you're 40, 43, 44, you finally built some equity in your home, you can finally maybe borrow for that business. But now borrowing for that business, you're not 25 anymore. It seems quite a bit risky when you're playing with your family home and you've got kids and you've got a wife or you've got a husband. And, the calculus has changed. And I think that's sad. And I think that's why we see, I mean, that's part of the reason why 30,000 more Australians left Australia than came into Australia in the last 12 months of data.
Yeah, that's a very telling proposition, isn't it? That some of the people who know what it's like in Australia is saying, "Oh, I give up. I'm going to go somewhere else." Of course, we've had a lot of people coming into Australia because Australia still looks attractive relative to some other places. But yeah, it's not good. And just going back to the statistics, the Jerritt Minnick slide is a really telling one, right? Because that really shows the true impact of what's happened with regard to house prices to GDP, which is way off the scale, which is another way of showing the distortion that that we've got. So this isn't normal.
Now, this is from the great Jerritt Minnick. He's been putting out this sort of data net for a long, long time now. One of my all-time favorites. And basically, it shows what the median house price, the ratio between the median house price and nominal GDP per capita is. So it basically removes inflation and all this other stuff from the equation and just gives you a very, very basic but very, very telling assessment of what housing looks like. As a ratio over time, all the way back going back to the 1900s. And it shows that even as late as 2000, things were still relatively normal, which is, when we saw the introduction of the capital gains tax discount, Howard jacking up the first home buyer grants, and then housing prices going to the moon. But I also think that this really helps with one of the big myths, or not necessarily myths, but big misconceptions about property in Australia. The idea is that property prices double every 10 years. And if you look across most of this chart, that's true. But part of the reason why it's true is because GDP and wages rose by a commensurate amount to housing prices. Whereas if you look in particular at the last, say, decade, housing prices have risen well in excess of GDP, even in nominal terms. And that is why you've seen it absolutely go to the moon since that sort of 2012, 2013 time when things started to go south. And I think it's also just worth noting as well that this is distorted by the impact of the rise of the LNG sector and the enormous amount of GDP per capita that we generate from the mining sector. If you remove that from the equation and then redraw the graph, it looks much worse. And it already looks bad.
Yeah, it does look pretty bad. I will make another point. I came to Australia in 1995, and I've been watching the market subsequent to that. In the early 2000s to 2000, 2001, 2002, when I started doing my surveys, I started questioning some of the strategies that were being rolled out at that point, saying if you're not careful, you're going to end up with house prices going accelerating away, and it's going to actually put more and more pressure on households, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, if you go back into the archives, you'll see some of my early ABC interviews in 2001, 2002, when I was actually saying this very point. And by about 2005, I got really concerned about the momentum that was being created and the fact that this was going to essentially create a housing crisis for the next generation. So I'm afraid I called it right, not that the policies were changed, because you could see the start of the deterioration. And it was partly because of the deregulation of the finance system. It was partly, as you say, the negative gearing and some of the other subsidies that were thrown into the housing sector. Howard's strategies in particular, I think, were part of that. The point I want to make is there was a set of decisions that were taken in that period, which has led to where we've got to. So this is not just an accident. This is not just, while history is a problem, right? This is actually deliberate policy over a generation plus that's led us to this point. So it's intentional.
I think that that is an important point because people, I often have debates, well, I often see debates more generally in the comments section of your videos or in on Twitter, and people talk about, maintaining the status quo. And I just feel like saying, well, what's the point of maintaining the status quo when we know that the incentive What I mean, Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett's business partner, once says, "Show me the incentive and I'll show you the result." What is the point of continuing the current status quo and the current incentives when we know what that is going to achieve? That just seems insane to me. I mean, it's by some, according to some people, that is the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result.
Yeah. Well, spot on. And it sort of is insanity, but if you look it through a completely political lens, it's all about getting re-elected. It's all about maintaining power. So there's actually a power continuum here, and I'm going to join the dots between the political system, the finance system, and the construction system, because they all are actually on the same circuit, as it were. So there's a very strong set of incentives from those powerful entities to play this out the way that it's played out. But it's not in the interests of ordinary people. It's not in the interests of ordinary Australians. And now we are sort of struggling to try and find what we do to fix it. Well, the old adage is, if I were you, I wouldn't start from here.
Pretty much. I mean, one of the ironic things I think about this whole situation is that we haven't seen cycles, business cycles, construction cycles, housing cycles being allowed to play out organically. And that's a problem because it creates distortions. And those distortions eventually come home to roost. Like, for example, if you look at the deterioration in the number of dwelling completions and in the level of activity in the construction sector, people are talking about this like it's the greatest cataclysm in the history of the country's construction sector. When in actual fact, if you go back to even non-recessionary construction cycles, say like those in the mid-1990s, it's not even as bad as that. It's just a normal cycle coming, in this instance, being allowed to come to an end because the government has its hands tied by inflation and the RBA has its hands tied by inflation. Yet it's not out of the ordinary. It's not abnormal in terms of its size and scope relative to the broader size of the construction sector. And part of the problem is since 2003, Australia has not been allowed to have a proper construction bust because construction busts are perfectly normal. They happen all the time. That's just it's a boom bust cycle sector. That's just the way it works because it's based around monetary policy. Monetary policy, gets looser. People build homes. Monetary policy gets tighter. The opposite occurs. So we haven't seen these cycles been allowed to play out. So sectors get bigger. Sectors get bloated. Sectors end up with dead wood in them, and you end up with issues with rising costs. Even though, in some cases, some of those people are not as productive as they should be. Now, a lot of them are, but that's just what happens in any industry, in any nation, when you have that level of inertia and entropy.
Yeah, it is consistent and it's repeatable. And I guess the other point there is that eventually, my theory is, Tarek, that you can try and buttress an economy or a particular trend, and you can throw more and more incentives in, but the quantum of those incentives have to get bigger and bigger. Your interventions have to get bigger and bigger to try and resist gravity. But ultimately, gravity is going to win. Something is going to break, and so it's a question of what will break? Will it be the fact that house prices go so high that nobody can afford it? Will it be that the construction sector disappears because nobody can afford to build? Or will it be something else? These things have a habit ultimately of coming unglued, but of course politicians in particular want to make sure it doesn't come unglued on their watch.
Yeah, pretty much. We should probably move on to the next slide.
Yeah, go.
Okay. This is from the AFR, and I believe it's from a Barrenjoey analysis that are based on their estimates of when the savings for households will run out. And well, basically, we're in the territory where where savings start to run out for the bottom 80% of households. So I do wonder to what degree this has been reflected in the ABS figures, because we're now actually starting to see household savings rise. Now, people might think, well, how does that work? If people have spent all their savings, why household savings rising now? Basically, my theory is that people were expending their savings, and that was offsetting the impact of the more affluent household are continuing to accrue their savings. But now that people have expended large portions of their savings and they don't really have any at-call savings to continue to burn through, in a lot of cases, you're seeing that rise because we're now just seeing the impact in aggregate net terms of the more affluent savings of households.
Yeah, well, the affluence is not equally spread, of course, and a lot of affluent households are benefiting from high stock markets as well as property price moves. The other factor in all of this is there was a considerable pay down of debt from those who had savings to be able to actually make their mortgage more manageable. And that has actually sucked out a lot of savings in that middle area. But then at the bottom end, those people didn't have savings in the first place. So they are already hand to mouth, and we're seeing that in our surveys too. So there's a drift effectively where there are still some holding huge amounts of savings, but that proportion is going down. But in the middle Australia, a lot of those are now, again, running out of flexibility. Of course, they do have the equity in the property, and we're still seeing equity make alive and well, and so that's one of the things that's also buttressing savings too.
I wish we had data on it. I really do. I wish we had like up to the minute data on it, like with the data provider Black Knight in the US. You get monthly reports on equity, mate. And I wish we had that.
They wouldn't want to share it because it's one of the secret ingredients that's helping to explain why things are the way they are. But it's not a particularly palatable story when people are encouraged effectively to pull magic money out of property prices that have gone up for no good reason, and then create, you know, that to be able to do stuff with. It's another of those feedback loops that, and I would have thought the RBA should be interested in this, but they don't seem to be.
Well, it's like did you see the recent parliamentary hearing, committee hearing, I should say, where the RBA got asked about the Bank of Mum and Dad, and they said,
Yes. Doesn't really worry us. We're not interested.
No, it's, I mean,
Fascinating.
it's only underpinning up to 75% of new home of first home
That's
buyer purchases, which are a huge element of the market. But who
yes.
cares about that?
Yeah, and the wealth transfer, et cetera, et cetera. No, it's crazy.
Yeah.
No, another example.
Yeah, pretty much. Okay, now we have heard a lot from the Albanese government in, well, let's call it the last 6 months in particular, that they are going to rein in migration, that they're going to do X, Y, and Z, make all these various changes, and that migration numbers are going to reduce. Now, as we discussed previously, that is not present in the September quarter data of 2023. Now, in fairness, that's not really all that surprising. These things act with rather significant lag. But the January data for net long-term and permanent arrivals showed the highest level ever by a significant margin. Now, I will note that this is not a perfect proxy for net overseas migration. It is far from it, but it does give you some sort of a directional idea of where things are going. And this suggests that migration may be continuing to accelerate. The big test, however, will be in February. Well, not in February, when we get the February data, because that will be the data that shows us what's going on to a fairly decent degree with student numbers. And that's where the government is really trying to rein things in, at least trying to. We'll see how that works.
Well, call me an old cynic, but a lot of students, of course, are not the ones who are actually buying properties. A lot of the students are actually in the rental sector, so it might put a little bit of downward pressure on rents in some areas. But the drift of migration seems to me to be towards people who actually have more capacity to buy property, so they come over with cash in their pocket already. Which actually may well mean that whilst the numbers could go down a little bit, the impact on the housing sector could be precisely opposite to what one might expect.
I think that there really needs to be a broader discussion on to what degree this is impacting the housing market. The data's there. The ABS has it. I know they have it. So to what degree is it impacting the market? And if it's so minor, then just tell people. I mean, we've got the NAB survey on the number of properties being bought by foreigners. And that's quite a different story sometimes to some of the FIRB data. And I think that there just needs to be that discussion because, at the end of the day, if something is occurring, the discussion needs to happen. I mean, it is, and we know it is occurring. And I think that just pretending that it's not just means that the discussion is going to happen elsewhere without context. Now, I do have some data which I'm going to put out in an article when I manage to finish my analysis on it and go through it, and so it's the point where I'm actually happy with it. But there needs to be more than that in the broader sphere of things, and I think that applies to a lot of things. There's a lot of different things that are going on at the moment where people deserve to know, and I think as well people like some various Labour supporters have said to me, well, businesses needed labor. All these people were crying out for it. And to be honest, I really don't give a crap what they were crying out for. So businesses wanted labor. Big whoop. The result has been the worst rental crisis in decades. I mean, and the rental crisis was already there. This has just exacerbated it. And I think that's just a really, really silly way to approach things. Because at the end of the day, the government is acting in the it should be acting in the interest of the broader Australian people, of all Australians, whether you've been here 5 minutes or for 50 years. And I just think that it's just silly that we don't have more of these discussions, more of this data put out there. Like, for example, I'm having to, play with all these different models and scenarios and stuff about what the housing deficit is. Why is there not an analysis on this from someone with the data and the manpower, firepower to be able to really, really, really get into it into a degree that would take me, a year? Why don't we have some heavy, some heavy hitters, some good information? How many homes do we need? When do we need them? How long is it going to take? Those are rather key questions that we should be ha that we should that the government should be answering.
Absolutely, that's right. And unfortunately, some of those big questions are actually ones that the government do not want to answer, or do not even want to know what the information would be to be able to create an answer, right? Because if they had the information out there, they'd have to respond to it. So I have a feeling that some of the filtering that we're seeing with regard to the information sets is quite deliberate, because people prefer not to know in people in positions of power. But those questions are critical questions. And I guess that's why you and I have these conversations, to try and actually, lift up the hood a little bit and say, hang on a moment, there's a really important question here which does need to be answered. How many properties do we need over the next decade or so? Where do they need to be? How many are we building? What's the gap? Which then leads automatically to, so what strategies are we going to develop to be able to actually close the gap? And from there, you then take the story forward. But no, this is critical stuff, and yet nobody wants to talk about it.
No, and I mean, even based on one of, my more basic scenarios, you're talking about a housing crisis that's going to continue into the 2030s. And that particular analysis assumed that housing starts, sorry, the housing completions will bottom at the end of this year, and then they will undergo and the equal largest proportional rise in Australian history and then stay there forever. So I've stacked the deck so far in favor of a positive outcome, and we're still talking 2030s before this is solved. And that is just an absolutely scary thought. Like, there are, kids in primary school who are going to be dealing with this in their adulthood. And that's nuts.
Well, I have a view that with the current field of play that we've got, and the current stakeholders and the current strategies, this won't be solved. This will just grind on and on and on and on, and will get more and more significant until something breaks more substantially, because there is no way that I can see a way out from this. Well, it's a bear trap, really. It's a trap that effectively has no exit, unless governments get serious about it. And I don't think there's a lot of lip service. There's a lots of announceables. There's a lots of this and that and the other, but actually, really, the fundamentals are not being tackled. The information sets aren't even readily accessible deliberately. And as a result of that, we get all of these sort of stupid shadow boxing things going on. But unfortunately, the long-term prognosis ain't great.
I have a feeling, I just get the feeling it's a little bit like a Chinese finger trap. If you just keep doing it and you keep pulling it, it's not going to work. You've got to, I mean, it's just like I was saying, you keep going with the status quo, you're just going to get keep stuck being stuck in that trap. But if you do something dramatically different, and the trap relaxes and you can actually address the issue.
Absolutely. And that's probably including the question of public housing, the question of the real true story of supply and demand, and then what strategies need to be executed, both from the migration side and from the construction side. Just before we go, Tarek, you've got just a couple of other slides which I think are just worth reflecting on, because there's a broader international context which actually could play out too.
Yes, there is. We'll try and get through them with relative swiftness. This is a slide from Shane Oliver at AMP that shows that basically that in aggregate, household savings are declining and have been declining now since the mid part of 2022. Now, I think this just goes to illustrate that, from that Barrenjoey chart that we had earlier, that just how much of the aggregate savings are held by the most affluent households.
That's pretty astonishing, isn't it?
Okay, now this one I particularly like because it shows the level of bond issuance that we're going to see in China and over the next 12 months. Now, one of the reasons why I find this chart very interesting is you look at it and you go, well, there's going to be more than last year. So that's not too bad. That sounds okay. But the way that Chinese bond issuance is reported is unlike, say, for example, with other nations where they report bonds being rolled over as not new issuance, in some instances, in terms of the way it's more broadly reported, this doesn't count new issuance separately. It's counted in this. So part of the issue is all those debts that were racked up in the lead up to COVID and during COVID are now having to be rolled over. And that presents a rather significant issue where we could see actually less money flowing to the Chinese construction, to the infrastructure construction sector than last year, which could potentially be significant. It just depends on the expiry and rollover of debts for the Chinese government and also for local government financing vehicles, which is unfortunately quite a bit more opaque.
Funny that. And of course, the latest is a 5% growth target from GDP over the next 12 months or so. And also, the central bank said, well, we might adjust the risk ratio down a little bit to allow the banks to lend a little bit more. But none of that is going to be of a quantum that's going to turn the economy down. So, more disinflation is probably going to. Purple, you know, percolate through the Chinese economy, which of course has a knock-on effect more broadly.
Indeed, it's going to be an interesting one on that, in that respect. And we'll just get through this last chart. Now, this is from S&P Global, and it's of where Russian oil depots, storage terminals, and refineries are in range of what they estimate is the range of Ukrainian drone strike range. Because in recent weeks, the Ukrainians have been hitting Russian oil infrastructure. This is seeing things like diesel prices in Europe. I'm talking about wholesale diesel prices in Europe rise because Europe still gets its diesel from Russia, and this is starting to cause problems across the board. In fact, just before the show, the Americans said to the Ukrainians, "Please stop doing this because it might end up causing a spike in oil prices or in various oil-related product prices, which are purchased from the Russians." So I think that that's going to be an interesting one going forward. Whether or not the Ukrainians actually listen, because the Russians just blew up a power generator at one of the Ukrainians' hydroelectric dams, and they're not going to be pleased about that, understandably so. And realistically, the Ukrainians also need a win every now and then in terms of hit striking targets. So it's going to be a challenging one because this could be something that could impact, because if we do start seeing oil depots hit and terminals, whereby the flow of oil out of Russia starts getting impacted, well, then you can have inflation, energy inflation 2.0, and things could get real messy real fast.
Yeah, and if you put those two things together, so you know the question of the Chinese economy and how that's going to play out and what the impact could be, particularly on Australia, and the risks of higher inflation from the energy sector, as you say, because of what's going on there and a few other things too. Plus, of course, as we mentioned, the Red Sea, right, and the fact that goods prices are rising because of the higher transportation costs. You maybe then come back to the broader understanding of why central banks are a bit iffy at the moment about doing anything, because, gee, there are some externalities that could have a major impact on things too, and of course that could include higher inflation. And if higher inflation emerges, then their ability to cut rates is taken off the table, and that then cascades into more pressure on more households, higher cost of mortgages, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a bit sticky at the minute, isn't it?
Yeah, and in that regard, Australia is one of the most uniquely exposed of all the countries in the world because we have, well, in terms of our household sector and from, the mortgage side of things anyway, because we do have those variable rate mortgages, the overwhelming majority of Australians are now on variable rates. And, things could get quite challenging if rates are not able to be cut. Because a lot of people are hanging out for those rate cuts. And not only that, but like I talk to people who are mortgage brokers, people in the finance sector who deal with mortgage holders, and people that the general perception in a lot of cases amongst mortgage holders is that rates are going to be crash dived, because once inflation's gone and everything's going to go back to the way it was. But I don't think we're going back to 0.1% 0.1% cash rate. I don't think that's going to happen unless something cataclysmic goes wrong. And at that point, you're not going to want a 0.1% cash rate. You're going to want things to be the way they were before, because it would take so much damage to drive that sort of outcome.
Yeah, and it takes us, without having time to explore it now in detail, but the R star, in other words, what is the neutral rate? And all the stuff that I've been reading is suggesting that the neutral rate, in other words, the rate of interest rates that has no impact, positive or negative, on the economy, is quite a lot higher than what people were thinking it was. Which means the implications are that even if rates do come down at some point, maybe end of this year, maybe into next year, they will come down only slightly from where they are now. And we're never going to go back to that 0.1%, cash rate, unless, as you say, there's a major, major, international crisis of some sort, which then is all bets are off. But in the normal course of events, interest rates will be higher than they've been for quite some time. They will be higher for longer, and that means that many people are going to have to actually come to quite a significant realization that the world changed a couple of years ago. And it's not necessarily going to go back to where it was in that ultra low rate cycle from 2007 till COVID, when central banks went stupid. And I'm afraid that I put a lot of the blame ultimately of to where we are at the moment on bad central bank policy over 20 years.
I agree. And just, very briefly on the neutral cash rate, Lucy Ellis, who used to be, I believe she was number two at the RBA, recently put out a note at Westpac, where she's now the chief economist. And she estimates that the neutral cash rate is about 3.1%. So even if we see, say a cash rate cut down to say 2.5%, 2.25, which is a sort of moderate accelerate, a moderately loose cash rate, that is sort of more of the ballpark of where we would see rates to be cut if we do see a more normal rate cut cycle going forward. Personally, I estimate somewhere between sort of 2.35 to 2.85 is around about where I estimate things sort of going if we see a normal rate cut cycle on the back of an economic downturn. More severe downturn, perhaps a little bit lower, but that's a far cry from where we were even before the pandemic.
Yeah, spot on. And well, we'll watch and wait. Very thoughtful conversation today, Tarek. Thank you very much for that. And I think that some of the issues that we've really spotlighted here are really critical. And I wish that some of our political leaders would take time to watch the show. They might learn something.
Well, if the viewers want to send a clip of the video, a clip of this video, they're more than welcome to.
Yeah.
I'd welcome a phone call or a DM from policymakers if they want my advice. They're more than welcome. It's $200 an hour.
Excellent, Tarek. Well, I hope you get lots of phone calls. Thank you very much. Really enjoyed that. And we'll do it all again down the track.
Catch you later, mate.
See
Appreciate
ya.
your time.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.